now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Good evening, everybody, everyone, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always been in you, as well as helping you find courage to reclaim that which you have always been. Very excited to be with you here tonight and every other Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And just in case you cannot spend the whole hour with me, don't sweat it, because these broadcasts are now podcasted. In case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. And these are now available for download on Audible and Amazon Music. I am Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, I just invite you to visit that website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. Okay. And if you would like to call in and be part of tonight's show, I invite you to call that toll-free line. It's 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And give me your insights. Give me your comments. Give me your thoughts on today's subject, the exquisite witness, living in the sacred neutral. Well, I am very pleased to announce that I'm now in my fifth year with BBS Radio, and it's been a blast every step of the way. And also to say that these broadcasts have always focused on the continued integration of our spirituality and our mental health, all within that greater context of our relationships that we have, not just with ourselves and others, but also God or the divine. And this integration of our spirituality and our mental health is very essential, because at any given moment, it's our minds that interpret what we take in through our senses. And based on our previous experiences or education levels or our upbringing and so forth, our mind's interpretation fails to capture a more accurate understanding of the deeper lessons and realities and greater truths. Now, what I mean is this, that because our egos, which everybody has, our egos are very self-centered and very limited. Our egos often come in, they want to take over, or they do take over, and they keep us from knowing ourselves as vast and eternal souls, as well as what needs to heal so that we can live in forgiveness, gratitude, and bliss and love. And admittedly, it's that ego of ours that often leads us astray with all kinds of thoughts and selfish pursuits, or a lower level consciousness, if you will, which is always going to be bound by time and space and causation. And yet, we also need to pay attention to our egos. We just can't quickly dismiss them, because our egos do have a lot to teach us. Because when we pay attention to our egos by asking ourselves in any given situation, all right, what in me has created this perception? Or what in me has created this reaction? Or what in me has created this distortion? So that I can better understand where my healing and transformation are still needed. And this is the reason why this integration of our spirituality and our mental health is essential for our awareness of who we are as souls. So, in other words, to remember who we are. And here's a quick example that I like to use that really hits home with a lot of people, because you know there's a huge difference between the worldly love, which is certainly more familiar to us, and godly or divine love. Now, according to my dear friend and my teacher, he would say that we often use the term, I love you. But that kind of love can be conditional because it's often based in very temporary and goes through changes and goes back and forth of conflicting emotions of the mind, such as envy or jealousy and hatred. You know, that kind of love, let's say that worldly love, can be very, very fickle. Now, on the other hand, godly or divine love is a love that's not entangled in the human emotions of the mind. Divine love is eternal. It's not conditional. And divine love helps us to purify our minds by recognizing only that which is divine in all. And this is really what reclaiming authenticity is all about. In fact, I really love to sum it up in one word, namaste, which roughly translated means, because I see myself as a soul of light, this allows me to greet your lighted soul of who you are, even if you have yet to see it in yourself. Because you see, indeed, we are social beings. There's just no getting around it. We live our lives in relationships. And we often spend the majority of our lives trying to make sense of our world and our relationships by trying to find, well, where do I fit in relationships? Where do I fit in this world? And it's often within the context of our relationships that we experience tremendous pain and suffering. And these could be anything from, you know, feeling betrayed or the cruelty that somebody has inflicted against us, or vice versa. You know, we may have betrayed or we may have acted cruelly against somebody else, to simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Many people bear the scars of, let's say, the physical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual woundedness. So the difficulty then is often finding the courage to discover not only that which has been in you, but who you are and always have been all along. And again, what I mean by that is, you know, to for us to discover our gifts, our graces, and our skills, our uniqueness that we come into the world with. It's what the Scottish Franciscan John Duns Scotus coined, a chaetas. It's a thisness. You know, as I explain it to kids, it's like a thumbprint. No two are alike. That's the uniqueness. But everybody is unique. That's something we also have in common, like a thumbprint. Because I'm of the firm belief that we do come into this world with everything we need for ourselves and others, but through our various experiences, we may have been giving away parts of ourselves, if not the whole piece of that uniqueness or our thisness. And maybe we did so because we didn't feel as though we could live up to another person's expectation of us. Or maybe we hid our uniqueness from others in order to survive a particular abuse. Or even perhaps those aspects of ourselves may have been taken away from us, and we just simply didn't have the strength to fight it. We didn't have the insight. We didn't have the awareness. And either way, that whenever we do become aware that we have done these things or things have been taken from us, this is where the courage comes in, because it does take tremendous courage to reclaim who we are. But we can reclaim our voice. And we can reclaim that uniqueness. And we can reclaim our thisness. And when this occurs, you know, we soon discover that we are going to begin to tell our stories of transformation from a different place in us, a place of healing, a place of wholeness, and gratitude. Well, I have to say that all we need to do is look around at the news that's coming out of the world, and whether it be right down the street or in the other parts of the world, thousands of miles from us, we're going through some difficult times, to say the least. And one of the aspects of suffering through, whether it's national tragedy or something on a more local level, or even with your own family, you know, it's that these tragedies do affect everyone, even down to the smallest towns and the communities within the nation. Because again, it all comes back through and to relationships. And yet, with every loss we experience in our lives and every disappointment, every tragedy even that we're faced with, sooner or later, they're all going to present us with this one challenge. Will this experience make me bitter? Or is this experience going to make me better? And this is where I find most people struggling between the two, one of those two extremes, because many people ask me, how? How does an experience have the potential to make me bitter? Or how does this experience have the potential to make me better? Well, perhaps we can flip this question around. That is, instead of a this or that question, instead, how about we realize that there is so much more to us than what we have become so far? And again, this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about, finding the courage to reclaim that which has always been in you from the beginning and who you truly are. You know, don't just be content with what you see, because in various scriptures throughout the world, what we see are often referred to as temporal and changing. But instead, choose to see what others cannot or do not want to see. You know, I've heard it put one time that, you know, look for the invisible people every day. The people we walk by, you know, day in and day out, and either choose not to see, or the ones we cannot see because of a narrow search for God. And ironically, we often discover this is exactly where God chooses to be seen, in this sacred neutral, in the ordinary. And so therefore, this potential for us to become better, more enlightened, more aware, is always there for us to realize, and to not just realize, but also to embrace and to live out on a daily basis. Well, a few weeks back, I remember talking about the phenomena called emotional intelligence, which, if you are familiar with that term, it was brought to the public's attention by Daniel Goleman and others, which, ironically, when placed within the context of careers and workplaces, focus on more of the soft skills or an emotional intelligence, you know, and they include interpersonal skills or how we treat one another. Do we have basic decency? Do we have understanding? And are we open and teachable? And over the years, there has been an interesting change in how Goleman's emotional intelligences has made its way into the workforce. Now, nowadays, employers seem to be interested in hiring people with, yes, they want the technical skills in order to do the job, but they also want people who possess emotional intelligence or these soft skills that I just mentioned. As one employer put it to me, he says, I can teach anybody a hard skill or how to run a machine or a computer program and so forth. But what I can't teach them are the soft skills or the non-technical skills that relate to how you do this job. And again, these include how you interact with colleagues, or how you solve problems and how you manage your work. These things must be cultivated within. the more work that we do on ourselves benefits all. And the effects of this emotional intelligence has been measured in various ways within the workforce, such as increased team performance, or improved decision making, or increased personal well-being. And it's also been seen in reducing staff turnover, or decreasing occupational stress, and increasing leadership ability. So it has many, many, many benefits when we focus on this. And, you know, as popular as emotional intelligence has become, there's a greater dimension to how often we understand and react to our emotions. And that is, how comfortable are we to just be able to sit with our emotions and resist the temptation to not only label them, to resist that, but also to avoid feeling guilty about our emotions? So, in other words, can we allow ourselves to be an exquisite witness and live in this sacred neutral? You know, the first time I ever heard the phrase exquisite witness was the first time I met Dr. Shep Jeffries. You know, he was teaching a summer graduate course on loss and grief at Loyola University in Columbia, Maryland, outside Baltimore. And I was taking the course. I was in graduate school at the time. And because I was coming from Pennsylvania, I decided to get an early start and get down there. And, you know, ironically, I was the first one there. And I walked in and, you know, he greeted me and, you know, hey, how you doing? You know, I'm Dr. Jeffries. And I said, hello, you know, I'm Jim Houck. Nice to meet you. And he said, you know, we're, you know, take a seat wherever. And, you know, he had arranged chairs in a semi-circle. And he was placing boxes of tissues, you know, in front of every third chair. Now, let me just paint this picture for you. Dr. Jeffries, Shep, he always reminded me of the old school version of a Lou Grant, you know, from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And that's okay if you never heard of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, you're not going to hurt my feelings. But just Google Lou Grant or Ed Asner, Lou Grant, and you'll get the picture. You know, and once he was done, you know, setting things up and placing these tissues around, he just sat, you know, quietly at his desk with a calm expression on his face, and he greeted everybody who came into the room. And I remember just looking at the faces of everybody who came in, you know, I just said, hello, how are you? You know, some students I knew, some I didn't. And it seemed like everybody was scoffing at these tissues. You know, and almost if we could read, you know, our thoughts to one another, you know, we all said, I don't need those things. You know, I don't, and they must be for somebody else. You know, the very idea of tissues in a loss and grief course. Well, once we were all there, we went through the syllabus and everything. And Shep also took the first hour. And he shared his stories, his own personal stories of loss and pain and grief and anger and frustration and healing. And wouldn't you know, before the hour was up, we were all diving for those tissues because he poured out his heart. He brought loss and grief into a very experiential learning process for everybody. And, you know, the only lessons I remember extensively about that four-week summer course were two things. One, his mantra, change equals loss equals grief. And two, his teachings on being an exquisite witness. And here's his definition, which is quite lengthy. The exquisite witness is a healthcare, pastoral, or volunteer care provider who enters this sacred space between two human souls having the deepest respect for the yearning, seeking, wishful hopes of the other to diminish pain and survive in a new world after a loss. The term exquisite witness encompasses my beliefs regarding the role of anyone who steps forward to help a grieving person. A medical or a mental health professional, teacher, a funeral director, fire, police, or rescue personnel, employee assistance counselor, a medical receptionist, or a family member who becomes the home giver can assume this role. An exquisite witness just might be a friend, someone from your faith community who comes to visit the family, or the surgeon who stops by the recovery room after removing a tumor and then proceeds to reassure the waiting loved ones. What distinguishes an exquisite witness is not one's level of training, but one's willingness to approach another human being with compassion and deep respect for that person's needs, fear, and grief. The exquisite nature of the interaction is measured in terms of respect, care, honesty, and the ability to hear and understand the grieving person's anger and confusion. It may take a little time. A gifted psychiatrist whom I accompanied on rounds for the medically ill patients at Johns Hopkins Hospital was able, during a 10-minute conversation, to answer patients' concerns and make them feel cared for, respected, and hopeful. I've also seen a member of the housekeeping staff on an inpatient AIDS unit calm an agitated patient with a smile and casual conversation about the Baltimore Orioles lineup. The term witness directs the care provider to understand the grief journey belongs to the grieving person, whether he or she has lost a loved one, has chronic or terminal illness, has been admitted to the hospital for tests, has a loved one who is ill or dying, or has new job responsibilities in a reorganized workplace. And as a witness, we observe more than we act, listen more than we talk, and follow more than we lead. Witnessing celebrates the dignity and authority of the grieving person. And, you know, what makes Shep Jeffries' exquisite witness definition very effective is that he always placed it first and foremost in the context of a head, a heart, and a hands approach. Because you see, an exquisite witness has to address the personal loss issues, you know, right there in the heart, and his knowledge about what to expect from a grieving person, that's the head. But they also have the skills to respond both usefully and reassuringly. That's the hands dimension. But how unfortunate that in societies, there is still much fear around emotions. In fact, there's a lot of confusion out there that emotions are the enemy, that to be emotional, let's say, is to be wrong. And that's simply not the case. We all have our God-given emotions, such as anger, joy, sadness, fear, disgust, surprise, and anticipation, just to name a few. And just as we have come into this world with the best of ourselves in terms of our mental dimensions, our physical dimensions, spiritual dimensions, we also come with our emotional dimension. So Daniel Goleman, and the author of Emotional Intelligence, states that feeling emotions is what makes life rich. And indeed, our lives are often comprised of many changing emotions. And I like that. I agree with that. And when we're able to understand emotions, we realize that emotions provide us important information about our needs as well as the needs of others. But it's important to understand how we handle our emotions, how we handle ours, and how we handle others, so that we can really uplift, or maybe not, in a relationship. The intensity of our emotions can cause us to say or do things that we just might regret later. In fact, whenever our emotions are strong, they can actually prevent us from maybe even speaking the truth or sharing things that have deep meaning for us. And oftentimes, we do not have the words to express what we are feeling. The author of the book, Say What You Mean, Orrin J. Sofer, states that emotions are really multifaceted and are typically felt in the body. And these can be quite intense. In an eruption of anger and fear and pain, we just might lash out at loved ones. Or, let's be honest here, we just might be on the receiving end of these emotionally charged words and wounds. But nevertheless, we often believe that our emotions are the enemy. And I don't know where that message comes from. You know, are we going to blame Hollywood? Are we going to blame society? Are we going to blame how we were taught, or, you know, whether or not we grew up in a family in which sharing emotions was encouraged or emotions were shut down, they just weren't expressed? I'd say it's all of the above. Now, to what degree or another that we think our emotions are the enemy, well, that's something else that needs to be teased out. But, you know, some people will want to run and hide from their emotions, or run from them, or maybe we've been told somehow, some way, not to trust our emotions. And I typically say, when it comes to working with people who have addictions, whether it is a sex addiction, or alcoholism, or drug addiction, or gambling addiction, or whatever the addiction is, that people, the whole reason they get into their addiction is to either feel something, or maybe they want to feel nothing. You know, maybe a person is so shut down emotionally because of the wounds that they carry, that the only way they feel something is to engage in addictive behavior or engage in a substance. Or maybe they are so overwhelmed with feeling just horrific emotions that they would rather not feel that. And so they turn to their or turn to an addiction to have that taken care of. But you know, either way, it keeps us from labeling our emotions for being either positive, negative, or bad, or good, whatever. Because we are pulled into our past because of previous wounds, or we fear being wounded again in the future. Well, either way, these extremes keep us from being fully present with one another. Because in my humble opinion, the hardest thing for many people is to sit with themselves without judging themselves. And herein lies the foundation of meditation. Meditation is awareness, to sit relaxed, to focus on your breath and allow yourself to be that exquisite witness with yourself. You know, not to judge your emotions, but allow them to speak to you and to draw your focus to deeper levels of awareness, living in that sacred neutral. Well, again, I invite you to call the toll-free line. It's 888-627-6008, and give me your insights and comments on thoughts on this subject. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Howe. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. All right, welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Well, as I stated earlier in the broadcast, like right before the break, that is, how we often believe that our emotions are the enemy. You know, we either want to run from them, or we want to hide from them, or we have been told not to trust our emotions, whatever message, negative message that we've received regarding our emotions. And I usually say that when it comes to addictions, that people either want to feel something or they want to feel nothing. And they often come away of not being able to trust their emotions. Because you see that we are either pulled in the direction of our past because of previous wounds, you know, those things that we've been through, things that we have experienced, and the memories that go with that, or we fear being wounded again in the future, and so we avoid, or we run from anything that looks like, smells like, sounds like the wounds that we have experienced. Either way, you know, these extremes keep us from being fully present with one another. And I know a lot of people, including myself, at times struggle with just to remain present, just be in the moment without the monkey mind bouncing back and forth from the past to the future, the past, the future, the past, and so forth, but just be in the moment. Be that exquisite witness. Because the hardest thing for many of us is to sit with ourselves without judging ourselves. You know, but yet this is the foundation of meditation, as I said, as I got close to the break. You know, just to be able to sit relaxed and focus on your breath and allow yourself to be that exquisite witness for yourself. You know, not to judge your emotions, but allow those emotions to come up and speak to you and draw your focus to deeper levels of awareness. Why am I feeling this way? How am I feeling this way? Where am I feeling this way? And of course, the ever popular question, what in me has caused this to occur? Where's my responsibility in all of this? That's living in sacred neutral. Well, you know, I love this time of the year because transformation is all around us in the cycle of, you know, the theme of death and resurrection. And each year we witness this cycle, you know, evident in the change of seasons. Summer gives way to autumn, which we're in right now, which one day autumn will give way to winter, which one day winter will give way to spring. And then so forth. It just continues. And you know, there's even a death resurrection metaphor that underlines this work of psychotherapy, this integration of our spirituality and our mental health. In fact, more often than not, transformation occurs in the most unlikely ways, especially if we're not paying attention. Well, years ago, I'll share this story with you. Years ago, in one of the mental health offices where I work, hung this framed quote from the family therapist, Virginia Satir. And Virginia Satir, she lived, I think it was like 1916 to 1988. And just a phenomenal, phenomenal pioneer in the work that she had done in family therapy. And this quote that was framed was just hanging there, and this is what it read. I want to love you without clutching. I want to appreciate you without judging. I want to join you without invading. Invite you without demanding. Leave you without guilt. I want to criticize you without blaming. And I want to help you without insulting. And if I can have the same from you, then we can truly meet each other. Well, day after day, I passed by this quote, you know, but I never really stopped to read it. You know, I glanced at the words and like, oh, okay, that's nice. But I never stopped to read it, let alone understand its impact on relationships, both within and without or outside of the counseling relationship. So one day I was eating my lunch and I read and reread that quote slowly. I even read it out loud. I remember thinking to myself, that's a powerful saying, but far too demanding. Too many conditions and too many changes would be required of people to reach this. Moreover, I assumed, it's unrealistic to place this kind of pressure on another person and expect them to keep their part of the bargain. Was I wrong? Because you see, in counseling and other pastoral settings I've been involved in, I have witnessed too many people, including myself, making excuses for not wanting to be authentic in relationships. Oh, I've been hurt. Well, you know, fool me once, shame on you. You know, she hurt my feelings. And so on, and so on, and so on. And yet, there was something resonating within me, identifying with those words, as if I had the truth staring at me right in the face. Now, funny how truth shows up. Just waiting for us to, like, oh, there it is. But you see, for the days and weeks that followed, this gnawing inside of me to reclaim my own authenticity only became stronger. And Satir's words pursued me like a shadow. And yet, little did I realize that I was reading her goals for her own life. Because, as I said, she was born in 1916, and Virginia Satir was certainly ahead of her time. And instead of viewing humanity's problems as stemming from the neurosis of her day, that's what it was called. It's called neurosis. But she believed problems were the result of how people were unprepared to cope with life's challenges, past, present, or future. And she used to say, life is not what it's supposed to be. It's what it is. The way you cope with it makes the difference. Life is not what it's supposed to be. It is what it is. The way you cope with it makes the difference. Because Satir believed that all people are equipped with the capacity for growth, transformation, and continuing education, focusing her technique on finding a person's true inner self. Kind of sounds like reclaiming authenticity. Well, where do you think I got it from? In fact, it could be said that Satir's life's passion in working with people, you know, individuals and families, was to empower them to live more congruent, genuine lives. And how often is authenticity a foreign concept to many people? Yet, despite not knowing what to call it, many people are still attracted to genuineness and desperately want more of it in their relationships. But just how real can a person be with others? Because, you know, it's one thing to look in the mirror. It's quite another matter altogether not to succumb to the opinion of others. See, too often we live our lives under the relentless bombardment of another person's conditions for acceptance. And Satir also used to say that we must not allow another person's limited perceptions to define us. Because when you think about it, we are raised with so many conditions placed on love and relationships, performance, and perspectives that we often approach life with a, well, what's the catch mentality. Kind of interesting, in another one of favorite books of mine, The Return of the Prodigal Son, Henry Nouwen, he paints a picture of just how unfulfilling conditional love really is. He writes, "At issue here is the question, to whom do I belong? God or the world? Many of my daily preoccupations suggest that I belong more to the world than to God. A little criticism here makes me angry, and a little rejection there makes me depressed. A little praise raises my spirits, and a little success excites me. It takes very little to raise me up, and it takes very little to thrust me down. Often, I'm like a small boat on the ocean, completely at the mercy of its waves. All the time and energy I spend in keeping some kind of balance and preventing myself from being tipped over and drowning shows that my life is mostly a struggle for survival. Not a holy struggle, but an anxious struggle resulting from the mistaken identity that it is the world that defines me. For as long as I keep running about asking, do you love me? Do you really love me? I give all power to the voices of the world and put myself in bondage because the world is filled with doubts. The world says, yes, I love you if you are good looking, intelligent, and wealthy. Yes, I love you if you have a good education, a good job, and good connections. Yes, I love you if you produce much, sell much, and buy much. There are endless ifs hidden in the world's love. These ifs enslave me, since it's impossible to respond adequately to all of them. The world's love is and always will be conditional. And as long as I keep looking for my true self in the world of conditional love, I will remain hooked to the world, crying, failing, and trying again. It's the world that fosters addictions because what it offers cannot satisfy the deepest craving of my heart." Very good point. Well, as I can say that in my work as a mental health therapist and a pastoral professional, I do assist people to become more authentic in their relationships, to take an honest look at themselves and consider what role and responsibility they have in relationships. And I start with myself. Totally honest out there, people. I start with myself. Because too often people want to blame others for their own mistakes or problems or sleepless nights and emotions. But if truth be told, according to the band The Eagles, so oftentimes it happens that we live our lives in chains and we never even know we have the key. Again, this philosophy sounds great, but it also takes tremendous courage to put the key in the lock, turn the key, let alone step out of the chains and walk in one's newfound freedom. And this is a similar metaphor, ironically, not that we're going to, quickly dart past Halloween and dart past Thanksgiving. But this is a similar metaphor here in Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Okay, and you have plenty of time. If you haven't had your own copy, order your own copy and sit and read it. Fascinating story. And it was written back in the 1800s, like the 1840s, I believe. And Charles Dickens was deeply disturbed. The whole reason he wrote this book, he was deeply disturbed by the way the poor were treated in his day. And his writings, among others, were often viewed in response to the British government that changed the welfare system known as the poor laws that required children to work in tin mines, factories, welfare applicants to work on treadmills, that is machine engine powered turning by walking. And in Dickens's eyes, the Industrial Revolution drove many people into poverty, while at the same time neglecting its obligation to provide humane social services. Now, A Christmas Carol is set on Christmas Eve in 1843, 7 years after the death of Ebenezer Scrooge's business partner, Jacob Marley. Now, to set the stage, Dickens describes Scrooge as a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. How'd you like that on your tombstone? And he just described him this way, one who found no room in his heart for any form of kindness or compassion or love or generosity. In fact, he despises Christmas, deciding to spend it alone, although he is invited to his nephew Fred's invitation for dinner. And he even goes so far as to chase away two gentlemen who ask him for a donation, provide a Christmas dinner for the poor. Well, that night, as you know the story, Scrooge is visited by Marley's ghost, and Jacob Marley is forced to wear the cumbersome chains of misery and regret in the afterlife, and he shows up to warn Scrooge to change from his greedy and unforgiving ways. Otherwise, he's going to experience the same miserable afterlife as he has. And then afterwards, Scrooge is then visited by three additional ghosts, each in its turn, and each visit detailed in a separate stave, that is, who accompany him to various scenes with the hope of achieving his transformation. Well, it worked, because by morning, Scrooge has undergone a complete transformation in his heart and in his soul. And he breathes a sigh of relief as he realizes that he has not missed Christmas and begins to lavish goodwill and gifts on anybody he meets. And moreover, he cannot keep his newfound joy to himself, especially to the Cratchit family. And the lesson is well concluded, that there is hope for all of humanity, because even the most covetous old sinner is capable of a change of heart. And yet, transformation occurs more than just on a heart level. It also occurs on an emotional level, on a psychological level, a physical level, yes, and even a spiritual level. See, not only does the soul take a journey, but the psyche has to take one as well. Despite the various psychological foundational models out there, whether it's psychoanalytical or cognitive behavioral or humanistic existential, that emphasize their own strengths and limitations, they all have this common thread, that despite the psychological problem at hand, they all measure healing in terms of striving toward living a more authentic life. That is an experience best characterized by the act of finding oneself, then living in accordance with the self. And moreover, by reclaiming authenticity, a person is much better positioned to move towards self-actualization and genuine satisfaction with life. Now, the existentialist and psychologist Rollo May states that this kind of transformation, this change, requires great courage, persevere because of the inner freedom, and to move on in one's inward journey into new realms. And that takes courage. See, authenticity allows one the ability to move past the preoccupation of things that are beyond one's control, as well as to abandon these unnecessary concerns over preconceived notions of others with respect to yourself. So, in short, it is the ultimate form of empowerment and responsibility. Discovering our authentic selves, as well as the daily commitment to live congruently and living in sacred neutral, we experience firsthand the personal freedom and responsibility that it produces. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Do have a good rest of your October. Be well, be safe, behave yourselves, and above all, may you rest comfortably by being in the sacred neutral. Have a good night.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.